Thanks for having me here. Get this started. So what I want to talk about is doing quantum computing in a regime where you have very little control over the system that you want to use as your quantum computer. So the talk is going to be basically four parts, and if I'm running a bit long, I'll skip to the third part. So the first part, I'm just going to talk about the problem of quantum state transfer. Now, we thought we were solving the problem when we did this, but it turns out someone already came up with the same solution. But it's still a nice introduction as to how the model works for for performing quantum computation. The second part, I'm going to talk about how you actually implement gates in this model. And then the third part is just a quick overview of little tricks you can do to decrease the amount of time it takes you to do a quantum algorithm in this architecture. And then the fourth part is going to be talking about making the whole thing fault tolerant, which isn't trivial in a controlled system. So the goal we want to achieve is basically, first of all, quantum state transfer, because that's going to give us an introduction into the problem. Then we want full universal quantum computing, only using global control of the intermediate qubits in a spin chain. The qubits on either end of the chain, the spins on either end, we're going to allow to address. We're going to allow them to be addressed. Now, this seems reasonable, since they only have one neighbor, which kind of marks them out as special sites, and so the energy levels will be a bit different. Spin chains are pretty common, and they turn up in lots of systems, so this seems like a reasonable model to work with. Okay, so the easiest way at getting to the heart of this scheme is to look at the swap circuit. So we want to transfer our quantum state. Naively, the easiest thing you can do is make a swap gate between two sockets. Now, if we're only interested in moving one quantum state, then we don't need quite as complicated a circuit. So if we know one of the input spins is zero, then we have a redundancy knot on the end, and we can get rid of it. So it gives us a shorter gate. So we can put Hadamards in either side and just pick out these plus states, so that's 1 over root 2, 0 plus 1. But this is just the same as was on the previous slide. So that reduces to this, and then we can put an array of these together to transport it, to transport the qubit down the chain. So something like this. Now, we have the pluses going on, going in either side. So it is sensitive to the initial state of the rest of the chain. So we can put in Hadamards just to make it more symmetric, so that everywhere we're doing a Hadamard gate, we're doing it to all spins at once. So now the initial state on every second spin changes from a plus to a zero. And now, because we have always a zero neighboring a plus, we can put in control Z gates to pad out the rest of the circuit and make it all symmetric without doing anything. The extra gates don't do anything because one of the, either the target or the control is always zero. Okay, so this gives us a nice way to transport a qubit from one end of the spin chain to the other end. If we have this initial state. As it turns out, it's not sensitive to this state. And I'll get to that in a minute. But either way, if we can do control Zs between all neighbors, and then we can do Hadamard gates to every spin in the chain, it will propagate the information in the chain. And as I mentioned earlier, Robert got to this for us, although we weren't aware of it at the time. So how do you make these control sets? Well, it turns out that the generating Hamiltonian for them is this thing here. So if I'm doing control sets between all of the...
Oh, excuse me. Could I make a remark here?
Sure.
What you just referenced is original to Gavin Brennan. So that idea is somewhat in disguise by Brennan
was that
years
used,
earlier.
Was that used for state transfer in mind?
Yeah.
Okay, sorry. Okay. So next we have, so we can expand out the control sets between neighbors to give us this generating Hamiltonian. And from that, we can write out an expression for the interaction, for this array of control Z gates between neighbors, which I'm calling X here. So you can see there's a ZZ term, which corresponds to an Ising interaction. So any system, any spin chain that we have an Ising interaction in, we can get this by just waiting for long enough. The second part is global phase. We can get a pair of that. And the last part, underlined in blue, are local rotations on the spins within the chain. Now, as it turns out, because of the regular array of control Zs, all the intermediate qubits will have the same rotation applied. So that's this thing on the end here. So this rotation is applied to every spin in the chain. And then all we need is the Ising interaction and local Z rotations on either end of the chain. And that's enough to give us these control Z gates. So we can do all this with global control plus the control of the ends of the chain. And then we can do all our Hadamards with global control as well, because that's just a global Y rotation. Well, that gives us a pseudo Hadamard, which is good enough. OK, so the way I want to look at what happens to states in this computer is to look in the Heisenberg picture. So I'm going to describe I'm going to describe logical states as some operator acting on the zero state, and then look at how those operators propagate. So basically, this is what I'm taking as my zero state for the chain. So I've got 0 plus, 0 plus, 0 plus. And that's just a state which doesn't interact at all under the control Zs. Nothing happens. And when you apply a Hadamard to it, the zeros change to pluses, and the pluses go to zeros. So if I apply Hadamard S, Hadamard S, Hadamard S, nothing happens except maybe I pick up a Hadamard. OK, so I'm going to look at how these sigma Xs, and if I'm looking at pluses, it will be sigma Zs, propagate under this HS iteration. OK, so basically they're all Clifford group operations. So it's easy to work out the rules for how they behave. So this is just a list. S's commute with control Z's. Sigma Z's commute with control Z, sigma X's don't. So you pick up an X gate. Sorry, you pick up a Z gate on the target, right, on the neighboring spin. So anywhere in the middle of the chain, if a sigma X comes true, you get a sigma Z either side. And then, obviously, Hadamard changes sigma Z to sigma X. So that gives us a way for working out what HS does, any number of iterates. So we can pull the poly operator through, and we get a string of poly operators that's applied again to the zero state on the previous slide. So we can plot that graphically. So what we have here is an X gate going through control Zs. So it spreads out into an X and two Zs. Then it goes through to Hadamard, so X changes to Z, Z to Xs, and so on. So we see it spreads out, basically hits the edges of the chain, and bounces off. So if we do this n plus 1 times on an n-spin chain, we mirror the chain. A qubit in state I goes to n minus I. So this is just the relation for poly operators under this HS iteration. So this is just saying that any qubit in the chain gets mirrored. The chain just gets mirrored. So
does it matter if the chain size is even or odd?
No. You can do it with n instead of n plus 1 if it's even, but n plus 1 doesn't do anything. The difference there between n and n plus 1 is that you pick up a Hadamard on every gate, but that's just a global positive fix. So we've done this experimentally. I've been working in collaboration with Lee Sharon and Jonathan Jones in the Clarendon in Oxford to realize this in NMR. So this is our molecule up here, alanine. And these are our three carbon 13 nuclei, which we're using. And this is just the signal strength of each of those. So the signal strength of C is higher. So when you look at any of the spectra, you get a non-characteristically big peak on C. And these are just the frequencies and the coupling strengths. So if we do a mirror inversion, it works like this. So it's a three-spin system. We have to do four rounds of the iterate. So this is it starting off at the beginning. This is it after four rounds of HS, eight rounds, and then 12 rounds. So it falls off a little bit with time, but that's mostly due to field inhomogeneities and also the relaxation. We've also compared this to a classical swap. A more conventional swap network. So we're just doing an array of swap gates to mirror the chain here, and that's so the blue is the scheme I've discussed, and the red is this more conventional approach. And you can see that the approach I've discussed actually does really well, and it suffers a lot less noise than the more conventional approach. And this is just a plot of the relative amplitudes with respect to time, and with respect to the number of iterations of HS.
So the more conventional approach requires individual distinguishability.
Yes, it does. It turns out that on the molecule we have, because it has only three spins, we could do it. We could make a direct comparison. But it seems that this global control approach is actually better, or at least in this system. And this is just so the circles are the conventional approach, and the stars are this HS approach. So these are the decay constants. But if you kind of subtract the expected amount of field inhomogeneity and relaxation of spins and so on, you get something like 13 cycles for the decay constant. So that's equivalent to transport over 52 spins, basically, for the qubits at either end of the chain. Okay, so now how do you do quantum computation in such a system? Well, we can track how the operators spread out for one qubit. And what I'm going to say is, let's use buffer qubits. We keep all the plus state ones in the plus state. We don't use them to try to encode any logical qubits at the moment. And the effect this has is that if we have a look at where the next qubit goes, there is no overlap at the edges. So there's only ever one qubit delocalized over an edge at a time. So here we have the qubit reaching the edge. This is Z operator, X, X, Z. And we notice it's acting on the zero state. So if we apply a local Z rotation here, you have effectively the equivalent of a big GHZ state. So doing a local Z is the same as doing a Z to the logical qubit. So we can use that to introduce a local rotation on the logical qubit by just controlling one of the spins over which it's delocalized. Okay. Now, to get to other rotations other than Z basis ones, what we want to do is change basis from Z to some other basis. Now, because the plus states are stabilized by the sigma x operator, any z rotation, sorry, any x rotation, will leave them as they are. There will just be some change in the global phase, which basically we don't care about because we can't measure. So we can use global or x rotations to change the basis of the system once all the qubits are localized again. So we go through one round, we can do the z rotations, then we can do or x by pi over 4, then another z rotation and minus pi over 4, which gives us an or y, and then or z again, which is sufficient to do any single qubit unitary. So we have or z, or y, or z. Now we want to discuss how you can do two qubit gates. So to do a two qubit gate, we can decouple the spin at one end. So we do this by stroboscopically applying the sigma x operator. So we do very quick rotations, or as quick as we can, and that cancels out the Ising interaction. So you now have a subchain across here, and this last spin is trapped. So this is letting a qubit propagate out, then trapping the control qubit. So we now have a shorter chain, which behaves exactly the same under this HS interaction. And then we can move in our target spin with this chain decoupled. And as soon as it reaches there, all we have to do is allow it to couple. And that gives us a control Z operation between the two. So to do this, what we do is we do one round of the control Zs with it decoupled. So that does a control Z on everything but that pair. And then we do a round with it coupled. And the two sets of control Zs cancel out on everything but the last spin, or the last pair. So that gives us a control Z between the two. Since that only goes into the phase, it gives us a control Z between the two logical qubits as well. So with those gates, we've got our control Zs, and we've got any local unitary we want. We can now do universal quantum computing, completely true global control, and these rotations on the end chains, the end spins of the chains. So one of the things we've done with that is to do the Deutsch algorithm, which works out pretty well. This is just the circuit for it here. So basically, we have, in this case, we have the qubit encoded on A and one on C, and B is our buffer state, which is why there is no signal. Okay, so these are the functions. So F00 is the identity, F01. So this is just executing this, and it works out pretty well. So it's a nice clean signal. So now I'm going to talk about some tricks you can do to speed up gates, because the length of time it takes to do a gate in all the circumstances I've discussed grows linearly with the size of the chain. Okay. So basically, you can pipeline things. When you do a rotation on one qubit in a cycle, you do your Z rotation. There's nothing to stop you doing Z rotations on all the other qubits at the same time. So although the time to take to do one gate grows as n, you can do them all in parallel. So you're not required to do sequential gates. And you can do pretty much the same thing with controlled phase operations. But here you use the same target, the same control again and again. You can use it off as many targets as you want in one cycle. So another trick you can do if you really want to squeeze everything you can out of your system is you can pack qubits more densely. So I left the middle spin in each case untouched, just in the plus state. But you can track what happens if you do a Z operator on that. So that gives us two orthogonal states. The problem is we have an overlap at the edge. So we have doing a local Z rotation here doesn't give us local Zs on either spin. It gives us a Zz interaction between the two spins. Well, actually, as it turns out, it's ZX as opposed to ZZ, just because this is an eigen. Well, the two orthogonal states are plus and minus instead of 0 and 1. But we can apply gates at the edges, and that will affect the system in some way. So entangling gates are easy, but how do we do local gates? The answer to that is a bit messy. You use this ZX interaction, and so this is ZX and this is XZ, to construct a swap circuit using just global pulses in between to do the local rotations that are required. And you pick up some junk on the rest of the spins in the system, but you swap one of the spins at edge, you know, one step closer to the side. And it doesn't really matter what junk we have in the rest of the system, because when we go backwards, it's going to all undo itself. So we just want to make sure the qubit we move out towards the side is clean. So this is what we're doing here. We've got an excitation on the middle spin, move it out to the side, Z rotation, and then move it back in. Okay, so with that now, because you've got this more densely packed system, you can do things like the Deutsch-Jose algorithm, because you've enough spins to do two qubits plus an ancilla. So this is what we did here. So this is just a knock gate and then a controlled knock, both of which work out pretty cleanly and give the right answers, as we'd expect. We haven't done some of the more complicated functions, or at least I haven't shown them here, such as the Toffee gate, because basically the signals from those aren't so good. It takes order n squared to do single qubit gates using this technique of swapping it out to the edge. As it turns out, there is a quicker way of doing that, and you can do them in order n, but it requires you to do a lot of gates on each qubit. So it's probably not very good for the sake of introducing noise into the system. Oh, okay. Sorry, I thought I had a little more about the dense packing in here. Basically, we can pack stuff into blocks. Blocks like these, with a buffer in between. Now, because we know how to do fast local rotations, once we have a buffer to one side of a qubit, we need to swap the qubit all the way to the edge of the chain. We just need to swap it to the edge of a block. Now, doing this takes order m squared, where m is the length of the chain, and then moving a block to the edge is order n, where n is the length of the spin chain. So the whole time to do a gate is n by n. So if you have a block size of 1, as was the initial case, then you have time n to do a gate. If you have a block size that covers the entire chain, where you've no qubits, it's n squared, but in between you've got a trade-off. So if you have any spare spins in the system, you can get quicker gates. Okay. And the last thing I was going to touch on is on doing fault-tolerant quantum computing in this way. Now, it's not immediately obvious that you can do fault-tolerant quantum computing with global control. The amount of time it takes to do a gate necessarily grows with the length of the chain. This means that the amount of errors you pick up during a gate increase with the length of the chain, which isn't good. That would mean you'd have some kind of threshold that falls off depending on the length of your chain, so you couldn't do scale or there are tricks you can do to get around this, though, because we don't necessarily need our error correction cycle to be different for each qubit. We essentially are going to encode all qubits the same way, and the ancillas will be the same, and the error correction cycle will be the same. So what we can do is we can do error correction on little subchains. So we can take our chain, break it up into two species. And the reason it has to be two species is that you have to be able to flush entropy out of the system, and it's coming in proportional to the left chain. You have to make sure you don't read out your qubits when you do this. So that would leave only the last spins. But those two spins only allow you to take entropy out at a constant rate, while the rate at which it's increasing is dependent on the length of the chain. So we need at least two spins so that one of the species can be read out periodically. So that's what I'm suggesting we do here. We take two different species and use them to make subchains. So we have a subchain of species A, then species B, species A, species B, species A. And we need to be able to reset species B, which we're going to use to flush the ancillates. So we want some kind of lambda structure so we don't need to know the state of it. So we can excite to one level and it will decay to the zero state no matter what it was in. Okay. So turns out you can do universal quantum computing on those subchains with exactly the scheme I talked about earlier. Basically, if we set all the species A chains to be zero, we can keep flushing them as often as we want. So we won't generate correlated errors. And then when we do an interaction between the species A and species B chain, or subchains, because one is acting on the zero state, which is an eigenstate of Z, we just get a local Z operator on the end of each subchain of species A, which encodes our logical qubits. So we can choose to couple the chains trivially. To decouple them, we just use stroboscopic X gates on one of the species, so species A or species B. This will commute with ZZ, so XX commutes with ZZ. But if we're only doing it on one species, it doesn't commute at the boundary of the chain because one has an X on it and one doesn't. So the connection between subchains is broken, but all the connections within the subchain remain. Okay, so we can use this to do local Z gates by just choosing the amount of time we couple them within the mirror cycle. So we can use this to introduce our local Z rotations on the end of these subchains, as long as we're doing exactly the same thing on each subchain, and as long as we do it in a mirror symmetric way, because we're going to be introducing the same Z rotation on either end of the spin chain, either end of the subchains. For this to be useful, we want to have an encoding that's something like this. We have our encoded qubits in the middle, back to back. So we have ancillas either side, so these will be the ancillas we're going to use for the error correction. Then we have an encoded qubit, another encoded qubit. So if we have the first qubit of this chain, of this encoded qubit, we have the first physical qubit here, then the first physical qubit of this one should be over here, so that the whole system is mirror symmetric. This means that the error correction procedure is also mirror symmetric. And we can do full universal quantum computing on that chain. We know we can do it as long as the operations are mirror symmetric, which means we can do both control phases between logical qubits, between these encoded qubits, or spins within them, and we can do any local operations on them we want. So certainly the local operations on this section of the chain, plus any two-qubit interactions between the ancilla and the encoded qubit, are enough to perform the error correction cycle. So what that leaves us with is a load of junk at the end of each chain. So we want to get rid of this junk to reset our ancillas to zero and start again. So to do this, we need a controlled operation between the species B qubits and species A. Now, this is actually really easy to do because we've been decoupling it the whole time, but we can choose to couple it. Now, if the species B chain is left in the zero state, then nothing happens. You get local Z rotations. But supposing you do Hadamard's to everything, then you do your controlled Z interaction between the two. And then you do Hadamard's again. What you've got is a control knot between the two gates, or between the neighboring spins on species A and species B. So we can interact the two species without affecting the rest of the chain. So we can use this to construct swap gates between the ends of the chain. And we can use those to perform local rotations within species feed chains. So we can basically swap off all the junk we generated in our error correction cycle onto the species feed chain. So we now have a clean set of zeros for the ancilla, going into the ancilla on species A. And the same thing happens on both sides. And then we have all the junk on species B. So all we do then is reset species B, and that flushes out all our ancilla regions. Okay, we need also to be able to do gates between neighboring blocks of species A. Because we could do any symmetric operations within species A chains, it means we can do control Zs, for example, between spins on opposite sides of the chain. Or we can do any sets of two qubit gates between chains as long as they're done in a symmetric way between the covert qubits. Now, control Z gate, for example, is always going to be symmetric, no matter what way you encode the qubits. So, what we do to do this, this interaction between the blocks of species A, is basically we set our ancillas to zero, then we do a controlled knot between the ends of the chains, just as if we were going to start swapping off the ancilla. But we just do one controlled knot off the end of the chain. This gives us, if these are our two qubits here and here, and with the zero chain in the middle, we have A, 0, 0, 0, and this is just a bit expanded. So these are, the dots are all zeros in this case. So we now do a mirror inversion on the subchain of species B. So where we've been flushing all our ancillas. And that swaps them around. So we have 0, 1, 1, 0, 0, 1, 1, 0 in the case where 1 was 0 and the other one was 1. Zeros in the case where they were all, where they were both 0, and 1, 1, and 1, 1 in the case where they're both 1. So all we have to do now is we couple the two spin chains, we couple the two species, so we can get a control Z operation between, a controlled phase operation between the end of the spin chains. So you have a controlled Z operation between species A and species B, just the end spins, and you cancel out all the other operations. So if we do a rotation, by pi over 4, that's no good because they'll cancel out. So all the phases will be plus again. But if we do a rotation by pi over 8 instead, because we have this 1, 1 and 1, 1, we're doubling the phase we pick up. So obviously we can do this for an arbitrary phase. We're just getting a phase of e to the I, 2 pi on this one. Or sorry, 2 theta, where theta is the angle of that you're rotating through with the interaction. So, I've left down pi there. But I was going to say, conditional pi over 8 gate gives us control Z between two qubits. You have to throw in a couple of local gates to do that. But it gives us the ZZ part.
Could I just ask for a clarification here? So the exchange, if you have two code blocks, you want to make them interact. The exchange is just via one gate at the boundary between the A and B guys?
Yes, but...
Sorry, because you guess what I'm concerned about.
Yeah, you're concerned about
error. It's not the same transversal operation.
Well, it actually is, because you don't know I haven't specified what spins are next to each other, or what's encoded.
So you would need to do it one after another.
Yeah, so you do them in parallel. You move two spins up either side of the logical block.
Yeah.
You do the control Z between those, you move them off, and then you've got two other spins. You flush the block out, then you do the same thing again.
Okay, but could you be potentially sort of concerned about error propagation here? So suppose one thing happens at this boundary and sort of is inherited from cycle to stay there, and then now you interact.
What do you mean by happening at the boundary around the body?
In error.
Yeah, but it would have to happen again and again at the boundary, but you don't have the same logical qubits at the boundary.
Okay, so then let me rephrase my question. Maybe let's make it simpler. So if you want to make arbitrarily long computations, with the length of the computation, you need to scale the block size.
Yeah, sure.
So, and because of the spread of information in your system, the time required for an encoded gate between two blocks scales at least linearly with the block size.
Yes.
But because everything is on the move during that cycle, it seems that you cannot continue with your error correction procedure within such a gate cycle. So again, the time between two successive error corrections is increasing. So again, you have accumulation of error.
Well, so the block size doesn't have, the block size is just going to be twice the length of the encoded qubit, because you have two encoded qubits plus twice the length of the ancillary.
Yeah, sure. That can be the code size is going to increase with the length of the computation.
Yeah, sure.
So the longer the computation, the longer it takes to do a gate, an encoded gate. An encoded entangled gate.
Yeah, but that, okay.
And it seems to me, because, I mean, if everything is on the move during such an entangled gate, then you cannot continue with your standard error correction procedure during performing an entangled gate. Is that the case?
When you're entangling between two qubits, you actually can. Once it's inside, once you've interacted at the edges of it, you can keep performing error correction. So I haven't done it.
So even within the gate, I mean, the gate requires so and so many individual cycles, but
species A and species B are completely separate. So we
can
do
different. You can make them interact.
Yeah, so I make them interact at the edges because...
Yeah, that takes the time.
Yeah, but the time to interact is constant. It's just the coupling structure.
Yeah, that's true.
Sorry. So your A blocks increase with the size of the error correction code, but your B blocks stay constant in size? Is that...
Well, they can be, yeah. Okay. There's no reason for them not to be. They're just there to flush out the entropy that you dump on as you pull across the qubits.
Okay, well, that doesn't answer my question, I guess. The A blocks increase in size. And, I mean, if you want to do a transversal gate, the time for the gate is going to be proportional to the A block size.
Yeah, but you can be error correcting while you're doing that.
Okay, that was my question. Good, thanks.
So, that's basically it. We can now perform all the operations we need for error correction. We can interact neighboring qubits, and we can interact subchains, species A subchains. So what this does is it gives us this kind of meta spin chain, where all the kind of the meta spins are actually these kind of protected qubits. They're encoded qubits that are being continually error corrected, and we have this Ising interaction again. Between between qubits in it. And we have a little more control in that we can alternate the interaction if we want. We can choose to do it between neighbors on one side or on the other side. But that doesn't really matter. We can do control Zs between neighbors on both sides if we want. And it's particularly trivial with something like the 7-qubit one. So that's fine, but we still don't have control over the qubits within the chain. We don't have individual control. We've just been doing the same thing on the blocks within it. So we have to superimpose the original scheme, or the scheme on top of it, to fix, not to fix anything, but to perform local gates within that on encoded qubits. So if you want to do something to one encoded qubit that you don't want to do on the other, you have to use a global control scheme. A global control scheme on top of this error correction procedure. But that's fine. We know how to do it. okay, the gates, the amount of time it takes to do a gate increases, but that's okay because we've got error correction going on, so we're not too concerned about that. And it scales linearly, so it's not inefficient. So that's basically it. So just to recap what I covered, I talked about doing full quantum computation with global control. The overhead is pretty low. It's about as low as you can get with global control. It's going to have to scale linearly with the size of the system, just because there's not enough opportunities to do different operations to do all the local gates you want if it doesn't scale linearly. And then just the acknowledgements, I want to thank Jason and Simon. Jason was my supervisor when I was in Ireland, and Simon's my supervisor now in Oxford. And then Lee Shao and Jonathan Jones did the experiments and more. And if you want to know more, there's the theory paper there, and the experimental one is on the archive. That's not yet accepted. So thank you very much.
More questions?
So, sorry, is the claim here the full harms that you have to have a threshold result, or
no? Because I'm not specifying an encoder. I'm saying you've got the gates to do whatever encoding you want, or so you can do whatever error correction codes you want. So the threshold is going to depend on which one you choose.
This is the part I don't understand. So getting back to not exactly Robert's question, but a closely related one. So you say you can, the single A block contains a block of your correcting code. I didn't follow the details, but the error correction cycle, and B blocks are the ones that are getting reset, so that's when the entropy is getting flushed out. But it seems to me that if you have a big block in error correction code, then the entropy, then kind of to reset ancillas, it takes a long time for that resetting to penetrate the middle of the safe block. Right?
Yeah, it can. There are tricks you can do to speed it up. So I've talked about basically the simplest case of where you have species A and species B, and you just have two logical units on species A. But you can actually break that up with chunks of species B if you want to bump entropy out quicker. It just becomes more complicated to do that.
Right. So if you actually wanted to prove that you have a threshold in this kind of system, you have to consider these more complicated arrangements. And presumably then,
this is still the full tolerance stuff isn't quite complete yet, which is why there's no paper listed. But we'll try to get a threshold at the moment. Okay.
So you think a threshold exists? And
yeah.
Does this require concatenation? And sort of
I haven't actually specified what code you're using. So, you can concatenate a code within it.
In this model. So physically, what exactly do you need the experimentalists to build? Or at least approximately, what kind of structure are we talking about?
You're talking about a spin chain, an analyzing spin chain that alternates between species A and species B.
So it's just A, B, A, B, A, B, A.
No, it's blocks of A and blocks of B, but the actual details of the block size depend on code you're implementing.
And the block is just a bunch of identical A's.
But presumably, when you want to do concatenation, then you can need a more complicated structure where you have small blocks and then bigger blocks.
But each block can be error-corrected on its own.
At the lower level.
Yeah.
And in addition, you need a control at the endpoints on the bare level. So just
on the very ends of the chain.
Yeah.
basically, if we want to implement our original scheme on top of this error correction, then yes, it would be, but I think would be, well, oh. To get control Z gates.
Would be probably at the top level.
Oh, no, no. No, you can induce local rotations on the spins
okay.
within that subchain just using the very last spins in the chain.
Okay.
But actually, you could impose your scheme on top of it and not have control over the ends at all.
Oh, all right.
Okay.
Thank
you, Jason.